It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us this morning. In early August, President Biden announced as part of his administration's Build Back Better plan, a new executive order that encourages auto manufacturers to significantly increase their output of electric vehicles within the next 10 years.
I'm signing an executive order setting out a target of 50% of all passenger vehicles sold by 2030 will be electric.
We're talking about electric cars, from the demand for these vehicles to challenges purchasing them and even charging them here in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about electric vehicles? What steps does Wisconsin need to take to make it more friendly and feasible for electric vehicles for you to purchase them or charge them? And if you own an electric car, why did you get it and how do you like it? Call in now, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jeremy Orr is the Emerging Technologies Program Manager for the nonprofit Renew Wisconsin, which promotes renewable energy efforts. Jeremy, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with some statistics. The Pew Research Center says there were almost 2 million electric vehicles registered in America as of 2020. The Renew Wisconsin website says that there are fewer than 9,000 electric vehicles here in Wisconsin. How do we compare to other states?
Yeah, sure. When you're looking at other states, just looking at like market share data and whatnot, Wisconsin currently is roughly about 25. That's looking at registration data from DOT. It's looking at market share and whatnot. It's looking at passenger electric vehicles. So we're currently ranked about 25, but there is an uptick in interest in electric vehicles throughout the state, which we're seeing from a lot of our stakeholders and partners and just people on the ground we chat with every day.
And, do we have a sense as to why, compared to other states right now, we have so few electric cars on the roadways?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are a lot of different policies in place in the states that I think, might draw manufacturers to sending electric vehicles to those states. For instance, California with its higher level of clean car standards and things of that nature. And I think just maybe lifestyle issues and perceptions of electric vehicles. We still have a long ways of education and outreach to do in Wisconsin. You've heard of the term range anxiety, especially in a cold weather climate like Wisconsin. Folks are worried that maybe their car's not going to make it from point A to point B, especially in the winter when battery ranges might decline significantly or enough to maybe cause alarm in some people. So that might have been a huge deterrent early on in Wisconsin. But as we've continued to, our outreach education going forward, letting folks know that, hey, even in your average, let's say like a Chevy Bolt, its average range of 238 miles in the winter, all of Bolt EV owners are still experiencing 160, 170 miles, even on a sub-zero day.
Well, we know that part of this, too, has to deal with infrastructure issues in Wisconsin. And I want to turn to a conversation that we had last week on the morning show. Wisconsin Department of Transportation Secretary Designee Craig Thompson spoke with host Kate Archer Kent about the future of infrastructure in the state. Here's what he had to say.
I think we're going to be moving much more rapidly to electrification of our transportation system than people realize. It's coming quick, and I think it'll be very good for the environment.
And so, Jeremy, what do you think about what Secretary Designee Thompson had to say?
No, I think he's spot on. I mean, when you look at infrastructure, right? So we'll start with most people do charge from home. 80% to 90%, depending on who you talk to, they charge from home for the most part. It's when you start traveling to, along corridors, you're looking at charging stations here and there. And that can be that perceived range anxiety. In some cases, I think it's real. Other cases, I don't think so. But like he was saying, we are going to move forward with a lot of infrastructure sooner than later. We've got projected, our VW 7 funds, for instance, there's a proposal to use $5 million of those funds just for stations in Wisconsin. That would be huge. And then looking at the federal level, a lot of the federal level infrastructure packages that potentially could trickle down to Wisconsin, we're talking almost $80 million that could find its way into the state. A large portion of that would likely just go to infrastructure, looking at how we could help facilitate EV adoption by actually deploying infrastructure along corridors, other underrepresented areas and rural areas and things of that nature.
We're talking to Jeremy Orr right now, Emerging Technologies Program Manager for the nonprofit Renew Wisconsin, which promotes renewable energy efforts. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mike in St. Lawrence. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I just heard the tail end of what you were talking about, charging stations, and that was my question. Not my question, my point. It would seem like if you could, I don't know, work with some of the major gas stations, I know that would be against them because they're charging electric cars instead of selling gas. But if you could make it more convenient to get a charge somewhere, that's the only thing that holds me back from driving. You know, I can plug it in when I'm home, but now I'm going to go down to Florida. And if I got to stop here for a charge and stop here for a charge and then stop for a motel and then stop for a charge and then stop for a charge and then, you know what I'm saying? Anyhow, that's my thought.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for that. And your response, Jeremy.
Yeah, no, it's a common concern shared by, you know, most people in the U.S., not just here in Wisconsin. You know, driving from point A to point B along the corridor. If I want to drive from Wisconsin to Florida, where do I stop? How long is it going to take to charge and whatnot, right? First, I'll say there are apps online you can look at. Like, for instance, the Alternative Fuels Data Center is a great tool. You can go online. You can map out an entire route. They have a station locator. They also have a mapping tool that you can use and select level 2, select DC fast, select Tesla, whatever it is. And you can map out along your route where you can stop and charge. So you know, within a certain amount of certainty that within 5 miles of that corridor, you'll find all these charging stations from that app all the way from where you're traveling. But also, yeah, like you said, the convenience, you know. So we might see a shift in how we do charge because of increased battery ranges, increased battery capacities, and different charging stations coming out of the market soon. But as it is right now, we like to deploy, you know, if you're traveling along a corridor, you know, keep it close to the corridor, the charging station, and charge somewhere where you can get out, grab a bite to eat, you know, use the restroom, shop for a moment, and come back to your car and travel again. I think in the past, that was more daunting when you think about the slower charging times you had in the past. But with increased technologies now, you're going to get X amount of range from these higher output charging stations now, and cars are better able to take that charge as well going forward. You're going to get a lot of mileage for less time charging going forward as we start, you know, as this battery technology increases and charging technology increases.
So drivers that might be curious about getting an electric car, they've just heard what you said about maybe on the front end of some travel, planning out their charging trip, as it were. What else do drivers need to know if they say, hey, I'm going to take the plunge?
Yeah, you mean in addition to like knowing where the charging stations are and whatnot?
Or just in general with buying a car?
Sure. I think, you know, first and foremost, check in with your local utility. They may have some rebates there for, a vehicle itself. They may have some rebates for a charging station if you're interested in having a charging station at your house, like a level 2 charging station. You know, because most people can plug right into the garage. It's level 1. You buy a vehicle, plug in your 110 volt in your garage, and you're good to go. But for those that want a higher charge, you can purchase level 2. But I'd say check in with your local utility. Also know that federal tax credits still exist for vehicles. You know, you have, I forget the range off the top of my head, $2,500 to $7,500, depending on the vehicle and depending on the manufacturer and whatnot. But take a look into that as well. You know, those tax credits can be significant in that, you know, in EVs, in a lot of regard, they still have a high sticker price. Even though long term, you are saving money over the long term because you're not getting oil changes, you know, reduced brake maintenance, reduced maintenance overall. There's still that initial sticker shock that people still experience. So take advantage of your utility rebates. Take advantage of, you know, federal tax credits, and take advantage of anything that might come down in the future at the state level or other federal initiatives that might come down.
We are talking about electric cars right now with Jeremy Orr of the nonprofit advocacy group Renew Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls right now. What do you want to know about the electric vehicle industry? If you own an electric car, what do you think about it? And if you're curious, we want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. Yeah. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the future of electric cars. According to the Pew Research Center, the fastest growing sector of electric vehicles are cars that run entirely on power. In 2020, there were more than a million all-electric vehicles registered in the United States, and that's up from just 300,000 4 years ago. And we want to hear from you. Are you considering buying an electric car? What about electric vehicles appeal to you? What concerns do you have? Call 800-642-1234. Our guest right now is Jeremy Orr, Emerging Technologies Program Manager for the nonprofit Renew Wisconsin, which promotes renewable energy efforts. Now, one thing I want to talk about are sales of these cars, but due to state law, there aren't direct-to-consumer sales of electric cars. But State Senator Dale Coyenga and Representative Adam Nalin have written a bill to change that. Can you talk a little bit about what is in that proposed legislation?
Yeah, for sure. So the direct sales legislation, hot topic right now, right? Basically, what that would allow, it would allow an EV, you know, any manufacturer of vehicles that manufactures EVs could sell that EV, you know, that electric vehicle directly to the consumer, whether online or set up shop here and sell directly to the consumer. That way, you know, there's no requirement to have a third-party franchise or third-party dealership franchise at that point. The manufacturer could set up shop and sell directly to the consumer, which would be significant because we have, in 2020, 45% of EV sales in Wisconsin were actually in-state, meaning they bought, you know, from the dealership, but 55% occurred out-of-state. That's 55% of all total sales in 2020 for electric vehicles. People had to leave the state to buy the vehicle and then bring that back into the state. So, I mean, talking about the lost, you know, sales revenue and other things, and just removing a market barrier for consumers to let them decide how they want to purchase an electric vehicle would be significant.
I want to go to our callers right now, Jeremy. We have Judy in Franklin. Hi, Judy.
Good morning.
What did you want to ask about?
Well, thanks. I have heard that the disposal of the electric car batteries is a huge ecological concern and environmental concern. So can you tell me if that's true or not?
Jeremy.
Yeah, it's a great question and a common concern. When you're looking at like battery recycling and whether it's toxic or not, there's federal legislation that actually mandates that, not just for electric vehicles, but batteries in general and other sorts of environmental issues. Off the top of my head, I think it's called CERCLA. But I may be wrong there. It might be something else. RCRA, RCRA. I forget what the actual acronyms actually stand for. But there is federal legislation actually mandates certain disposal of toxic materials. Now, when it comes to electric vehicle batteries, you know, there is a huge push to do more recycling of batteries when they get down to 90% life or 80% life to actually recycle them. You know, if you're starting to see that movement around the U.S., which is great, you know, we can just reuse those batteries, recycle them, reuse them. Use them in different vehicles, whatnot. You see individuals doing this themselves where they'll buy used batteries and then convert a traditional vehicle into an electric vehicle using that battery, and the battery's just fine. So rather than just disposing, you know, outright, folks are actually recycling and reusing those batteries. And that's a huge, huge thing going forward when you're talking about raw materials in the extractive industry and how we can better accommodate that as well.
And I'm not sure if you have the specifics, but I want to throw this out there that compared to the pollution we might see from batteries, how does it compare to the petroleum industry currently?
Did you ask the extractive portion? Was that the question?
Yeah, if we could just take a deeper dive there.
Yeah, I don't have numbers as far as the extractive, you know, how much the extractive industry itself, you know, the battery industry versus, you know, your traditional gas industry. But I do know that the recycling would cut down that demand significantly going forward and help meet market demand for EVs as we go forward.
We're talking to Jeremy Orr right now, Emerging Technologies Program Manager for the nonprofit Renew Wisconsin, which promotes renewable energy efforts. I'm going to go back to our calls right now. We have Saul in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi. One, he just brought up another point, and that is he's talking about reuse, not recycling, and two different questions. The second thing is Foxconn is talking about building chassis for electric vehicles. They've already got a deal with Fisker and have cooperative agreements with Microsoft and some other high-tech manufacturers. And yet, as far as I can tell, the state is not engaged in any active pursuit in getting that Mount Pleasant plant converted to making electric vehicles. I wonder if your guest knows anything about it.
Thanks for that call, Saul. Jeremy, what do you think?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. It's something I think is brought up, frequently with folks. I think the main thing to understand, though, when it comes to whether any manufacturer would, in fact, utilize Foxconn's facility for manufacturing EVs, I think the main thing we have to realize right now is the direct sales. That's a huge impediment. Without having direct sales, it's a huge impediment for any manufacturer to actually want to set up shop in Wisconsin and then, manufacture electric vehicles in Wisconsin and then sell directly to the consumer. So I think once we get past that hurdle of direct sales, if that legislation passes, then we can start talking to our EV manufacturer partners and say, hey, do you want to set up shop here in Wisconsin? Do you want to manufacture EVs and do you want to sell directly to the consumer? So there are no guarantees, of course, but the main impediment people look at right now is just direct sales.
And thank you so much for that call, Saul. I'm going to go right back to the lines because we've got a lot of people who have questions and comments. Lynn in Stevens Point. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I wanted to address the question of why people buy electric vehicles. My first job out of college as a chemist was working for Amoco Oil Corporation down in Chicago. And my job was to test badges that were worn by employees of Amoco that worked at their oil refineries. And what I was testing them for was benzene. Benzene has been known since 1960 to cause leukemia. After testing and learning that employees were exposed to this benzene on a regular basis every day at work, and then when they reached their maximum level, they were let go. They had to find another job. I just didn't like the idea of disposable people being exposed to things that caused cancer. So that was my motivating factor for buying an electric vehicle. I bought one last year, a Chevy Volt, and I'm very happy with it. It's good for commuting. It's good for errands. I can run on electricity for all those things.
Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Do you hear about, similar stories from people who do make the switch that there are just so many bigger societal issues that are playing a role in the purchases that they're making?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are a number of factors why people do go electric, and that's a great example. That kind of reminds me of the public health or even the environmental health sort of, viewpoint, which a lot of folks transition to EVs for, especially a lot of the early adopters, looking at public health, looking at, just general emissions from vehicles and how can they, better accommodate that, decreasing emissions, they purchase an electric vehicle, looking at public health, looking at environment. Also just availability, what's available on the market now. As the EV market has grown and as people become more aware of electric vehicles, they're more prone to seeing what's out there, what options are there. Like even here in Madison, the Madison area, we've got, the VW ID.4, we've got a Mustang Mach-E, we've got Nissan Leaf, we've got the Audi e-tron, Chevy Bolt, BMW i3. The number of options are increasing. We've got the Ford F-150 Lightning coming out, the Ford, electric truck coming out next year, I believe. So I think a lot of it, too, was initially, aside from early adopters transferring over for, converting to electric vehicles for various reasons, I think now it's becoming more because they're more available. People are more aware of electric vehicles, how far they actually can drive. That we're, constantly promoting that, range anxiety is kind of a thing in the past almost now. It's going away. As we increase infrastructure deployment and also as we have increased battery ranges, look at any electric vehicle. You're going to see 200, 300 mile ranges per charge. That's significant. So I think when we're looking at why people are buying now, I think it's because of that. I think it's because they just understand better about what electric vehicles are, how far they can drive, and just the benefits overall of them.
So we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask a question on Lisa's behalf. She wrote in to ask, first, how much does it charge to cost your electric vehicle when you're not at home? And does any kind of charger work with any brand of car? For instance, could she charge a Honda at a Tesla charger?
So the second question, no. However, Tesla is, so we all know Tesla has its own proprietary sort of charging stations. However, Elon has made the announcement a couple months ago that Tesla is going to open up its stations to CCS compatibility, meaning any newer vehicle on the market that's not a Tesla can, you know, charge there. Now, when that's going to happen, I don't know. But as far as cost to charge, it really depends on, there's so many different variables involved on who's the site host, meaning where's the charging station, who owns it, who operates it. But generally speaking, there are different ways to charge, you know, whether it's a flat fee, whether it's per kilowatt minute, whether it's per kilowatt hour. And it really depends on who the site host is. But it's generally, you can take a look at, again, go back to the Alternative Fuels Data Center. You can actually go there. You can look at a station, click on it. It'll tell you exactly how much that particular site host charges for that station, just so you're aware of how much you're going to be paying in a charge.
Well, Jeremy, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Jeremy Orr is the Emerging Technologies Program Manager for the nonprofit Renew Wisconsin, which promotes renewable energy efforts. And he joined us today to talk about the growing electric vehicle industry. Up next is news and a story of our Wisconsin life. Then we talk about challenges facing school districts as they face a bus driver shortage. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about a nocturnal hunt for a strange creature wandering the streets of Eau Claire.
Was it a badger? Was it a bobcat? Or was it just an abnormally large, trash-eating house cat? Author B.J. Hollers tells the story of his family's urban tracking expedition in search of the Beast of the East Hill.
Had Jeff DeGrave simply seen a badger on Badger Avenue, it would have made a lot more sense. Yet what he saw on that November night was a creature that seemed far bigger and more dangerous than that. For the 10 seconds in which it loped past his headlights, Jeff observed an animal larger and faster and far more feline than any old badger. That's insane, Jeff thought as he peered out his car's windshield. What kind of house cat's as big as a golden retriever? The answer is no house cat. What Jeff had seen, or thought he had seen, was a new visitor to Eau Claire's East Hill neighborhood. It was about 7:30 at night, so it was dark, Jeff recounted, and this cat comes, I wouldn't say racing, but certainly at a pretty good pace. From left to right, the creature crossed Badger Avenue, never slowing to acknowledge Jeff or the car. It was basically a perfect profile, Jeff said, probably 15 feet from the headlights. Plenty close, he said, to note the golden-brown coloring and dappled spots of a bobcat. And just how sure are you about what you saw? I asked him. Well, I am 100% sure that it was not a house cat, Jeff said, and I'm also 100% sure it was a cat, which significantly narrowed our options. 15 minutes after receiving the tip, I reached out to a journalist friend who confirmed that he, too, had recently been contacted about a bobcat sighting near East Hill's Boyd Park. I'd heard enough. Wasting no time, I reached for my binoculars, preparing to strike out in search of the beast. But because it's not every day one goes on a bobcat hunt, my family demanded to come along. But it might not be safe, I tried. My wife, whose confidence in my bobcat tracking skills can best be described as no confidence, assured me they'd be fine. I loaded our brood into the minivan, then prepped the children on what we were in search of. A creature bigger than a house cat and smaller than a cougar. What's a house cat? My daughter asked. What's a cougar? Asked my son. Sighing, I drove us all into the dark. What began as a somewhat serious expedition to uncover the region's rare fauna soon devolved into a nighttime playdate at the park. After half an hour of underdogs on the swings, the bobcat, unsurprisingly, remained undetected. Though my half-baked bobcat hunt yielded little, that hardly means one isn't around. I wouldn't be all that surprised by a bobcat sighting, Wisconsin DNR wildlife biologist Terry Sherratt told me in the days following my hunt. As we encroach more and more on wildlife, they realize that we don't pose much of a threat. And then they find that there are some advantages to being around us, too. Terry's talking about food, how one person's trash is a bobcat's ready-made meal. It's worth noting, too, that the Chippewa Valley is well within the bobcat's native range, and, in recent years, has made a comeback. Of course, bobcats know nothing of comebacks or boundaries either. They go where their stomachs lead them. As they encroach upon our terrain, we might remember that we encroached upon theirs first, that the return, on occasion, to offer us a glimpse of the unseen world is more than we deserve. A reminder that we are, as Wisconsin conservationist Aldo Leopold once wrote, only a fellow voyager with other creatures. If one day we are lucky enough to glimpse a bobbed tail in the headlights, let us respond not with horror, but humility. Not with a shout or a scream, but a whisper. Hello, old friend. Welcome home.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm J. Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. As schools across the country prepare to reopen their doors for in-person learning, many districts are facing a shortage of school bus drivers, and Wisconsin is feeling the pinch. For example, according to WTMJ, Milwaukee Public Schools were down around 80 drivers for the school year this summer. And this issue is nothing new. In a survey conducted by the National Association of Pupil Transportation in 2016, 87% of school officials reported that the bus driver shortage was a major problem. Our next guests join us to talk about the issue here in Wisconsin and how school districts and families can deal with the driver shortage. And we want to hear from you. Are you a school bus driver? Do you worry about your safety? What steps are you taking to keep yourself from getting sick? And if you left the industry, let us know. Call 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dan Cobison is the vice president of Cobison Buses, which is based in Kokana, Wisconsin. That's in northeast Wisconsin. Welcome to the morning show, Dan.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Peterson. Oh, thanks. Jennifer Peterson is the HR director of Student Transit, which serves the Eau Claire and Altoona region. Jennifer, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thank you, too. And it's actually Jennifer DeWitt's. I got married.
Oh, well, congratulations. Jennifer, we'll stick with you. The Eau Claire Area School District plans to return to full-time in-person learning this fall. Where does Student Transit stand with having enough drivers?
You know what, compared to the end of the school year last year, I think that we seem to be sitting a little bit better than some of the districts that I've heard, like just what you were saying. So far we just had our back to work meeting and we didn't get any surprises there. And so we're hoping that nothing comes up in the next couple of weeks. And we were able to hire some really good candidates over the summer. And so we're praying that everything goes great.
And Dan, Cobison Buses serves about 32 school districts in the northeastern part of the state. How is your company doing with getting bus drivers ready for the upcoming school year?
Actually, we're all over the state. We're doing okay in most of the rural areas. It's the urban areas, in particular the Madison market, that is in really dire straits. It's just a challenge to find drivers down there. We've raised rates. We've done whatever we could to find more drivers, but we're really challenged. We're in the DeForest and Sun Prairie school districts. Both those school districts are probably, well, at least 10 drivers short. So we're really in dire straits in that region.
Now, bus driving isn't just getting students to and from, you know, their classes. Dan, you found a solution to get students to after-school activities and sports, even though there is a current bus driver shortage. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're working with the school districts and asking them to get to their coaches and whomever else, their support staff, and asking them if they would be interested in driving bus. We have coaches that are now driving the bus, and they drive the bus to the event, and they're being double paid. So they're being paid to coach the game while they're at the event, and they're also being paid to drive, to and from the event. It's also a good, you know, part-time job for somebody who's just looking for a little extra work. You get paid to go to those events. So if you're a football fan or a track fan, you can, you know, drive to and from and get paid to watch the events.
We're talking to Dan Cobison. He's vice president of Cobison Buses, which is based in Kaukauna. And Jennifer DeWitts is the HR director of Student Transit, which serves the Eau Claire and Altoona region. And we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. Now, Jennifer, some Wisconsin school districts are hiring maintenance personnel or teachers as drivers. Who are you hiring as drivers, you know, for these buses?
Our people actually come from all different kinds of positions. We have a lot of retirees, people that have retired police officers, firefighters, teachers, pilots, anything that you can think, you know, any background you can think of. There's all kinds of different people down here. We get a lot of parents, because this is a great job for parents, because we let them bring their kids on the route with them. So that saves a ton of money in daycare. College students, it's kind of a good schedule for them to be able to plan their classes in between their routes. So for some of them, that works out real good. I guess we have a wide variety of people down here. And of course, our staff, the management team, the owners, myself, the safety director, our student behavior liaison, training, you know, all of us drive and pretty much last year, we were all driving pretty much every day. So.
Now, when it comes to wages for these drivers, Jennifer, and I'm going to stick with you really quickly here. Student Transit pays school bus drivers a little bit more than $15, close to $16 per hour. Any chance, given that there is a shortage, that you could raise those wages to maybe make it a little bit more of an incentive for people to sign up to, you know, drive these buses for kids?
Yep. So our starting wage is $15.70, and we just raised that in March of this past year. And then our top drivers make $22 an hour. And we're kind of looking at all kinds of different options to attract people. And I think the savings in daycare is huge for like parents. You know, my daughter was one that she drove here when she had her second child, because she was looking at going back to work and not seeing hardly any of her paycheck. And so by coming here, she was able to bring the little one on the route, bring the older one to school. And she's, you know, that was a huge savings to her to be able to keep her entire paycheck. So that's kind of a bonus there too.
And Dan, I'll turn to you. Can you talk about the wages that Cobison Buses provides its drivers?
Yeah, we've gone all out this year. We've raised our wages $2 an hour, starting wage $2 an hour, and across the board, really, $2 an hour. So we start at $19 an hour and go up to $23 an hour. We also offer an annual bonus of $2,100 and a referral bonus of $500. So when a current driver refers another driver, we found that that's a really good source of new employees, is referrals through our current employees. So we offer $500 for that. And as Jennifer said, you know, having those extra perks, it's a flexible job. It's, you can take your kids along the routes. It's, you know, we offer positions in the morning or just in the PM, either way. If that's what somebody wants to do, if they have another job, or let's say they want to golf in the afternoons and they want to just drive her out in the morning or just get out of the house in the morning, that's perfect. We'll work around that.
We are talking to Dan Cobison right now, vice president of Cobison Buses, which serves 32 school districts in Northeast Wisconsin. And Jennifer DeWitts is the HR director of Student Transit, which serves the Eau Claire and Altoona region. We're talking about the school bus driver shortage and taking your calls. What questions do you have about the issue? How have you or your family experienced the shortage? And if you are or were a school bus driver, we want to hear from you. Call 800 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're talking about the school bus driver shortage here in Wisconsin and across the country. It's been a growing problem over the years, but has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And we want to hear from you, teachers and administrators. What does your staffing look like in terms of bus drivers? Are you searching for drivers? What's the hiring process been like during the pandemic? And parents, do your child's schools have enough bus routes? Is your school district feeling the pinch there? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Of course, you can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're joined by Dan Kobison and Jennifer DeWitts. They both work for school bus companies here in Wisconsin. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Josh from Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. I just have a question. I mean, I understand that you bumped your wages and everything, but how many hours would a typical full-time driver get in a week? Because bumping the money doesn't mean anything if you don't have the hours.
Josh, thank you so much for that call. And Dan, I'll throw it to you. What is your response?
Generally, if you have an AM and PM school bus route, it's about 25 hours. If you're lucky enough to have a noon route, you're probably in the 30 to 32 route hours. And then there's always the extracurricular stuff. So you could stay in the 30 to 30, you know, somewhere in the 30-hour range. Generally, it is a part-time position that is, you know, our challenge. And it is generally a split time period. So you have an AM and a PM piece of that, and then sometimes a noon piece. So you're in the 30-hour range.
And Josh, thank you so much for that call. Now, Jennifer, I want to turn to you. Some Wisconsin school bus drivers say that districts had a problem finding enough drivers before the pandemic. Have you seen that in the Eau Claire area?
Actually, yeah. Before the pandemic, it seemed like it was such an employee's market out there. There was people could go to wherever they wanted and get jobs. There were so many jobs out there. The wages were increasing on their own due to that. And, you know, people had that that ability to job hop. So, yeah, we had seen that before the pandemic. There was just a lot of choices out there for people.
And
so we were trying to create a good work environment and attract and retain our staff. You know, just trying to think of whatever we could do to make that happen.
And Dan, did you experience that as well?
Sure. It's been a deteriorating marketplace for us for years. And as Jennifer pointed out, a lot of our folks are semi-retired folks. So I kind of attribute it a little bit to the baby boomers are kind of, I mean, we're running to the end of the baby boom generation, and there's less and less folks in that semi-retired situation. Lots of folks are staying either employed or they're becoming, you know, unemployed, or they're retiring completely. So we're losing that piece of our fundable group of people that are out there. So that numbers have been dwindling over the years. That's correct.
We're talking to Dan Kobison right now, Vice President of Kobison Buses, which is based in Kaukauna. And then we have Jennifer DeWitts with us, the HR Director of Student Transit, which serves the Eau Claire and Altoona region. And we are taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions or thoughts. And if you are a school bus driver, we want to hear from you. Now, Jennifer, right now masks are optional for students and staff inside the Eau Claire area school district buildings. The CDC, however, requires masks on school buses and other forms of transportation. You know, what's the situation like if a student refuses to wear a mask on a bus, and how might that impact your drivers?
You know, we're following guidelines that are in place from the FMCSA, but I'm sure that a lot of people, you know, understand that, like the drivers as well as teachers, there's a lot of things going on in the classroom and on the bus that require the attention of the driver or the teacher to, you know, that are safety issues. And so like with our drivers, you know, they have a big responsibility out there to keep those kids safe and get them to and from school. And that's our main priority, is keeping those kids safe. And so you've got a lot of issues going on that bus itself, and then as well as traffic around there that you're trying to navigate through and everything that you're doing. So, but we're right now following the guidelines from the MCSA, and hopefully with a lot of understanding from parents and teachers and staff and children.
And Dan, I want to turn the question to you. How, since you serve a different region of the state, how is your company handling, mask wearing policies?
We are basically, because again, we service so many different school districts, we don't really have a stance on it. We are allowing each school district to specify what they would like to put into place. We don't think that the FMCSA has a stance on this. The TSA has a stance on masking, and the TSA does not cover school buses. So it is a gray area, let's put it that way, because the CDC does recommend it, but it is a gray area. So we're allowing each school district to make their own decision and let us know what they would like us to do on the buses.
Jennifer, I'm going to turn back to you because, you know, part of your job is hiring school bus drivers. Certainly over the last year, we've seen a number of issues such as unemployment and all of that. How is that factoring into your outreach and ultimately hiring people? Is it causing any issues?
Yes, it actually has. You know, we have a great group of people. But there has been times where we've asked people to, you know, if they could step up, maybe where we had to combine routes or do something creative. And there were times where people have said, I can't do that because that will affect my unemployment. It's hard to blame them if they're going to make $16 to $20 an hour. You know, if that just 1 hour or 2 hours of work could make them lose the additional $300 to $600 that was being given to them. And so that has been kind of a struggle. You know, we even had given out a bonus, and unfortunately that kind of backfired on us from some people too, because then that affected their unemployment, and that's kind of a struggle and has been hard to deal with, I guess.
And Dan, just since we're running a little low on time, make the case, why should people become school bus drivers?
Well, you should become a school bus driver just because you're contributing to the economy, you're contributing to the community that you're living in. You get to work with kids, which is great, but at the same time, you don't have, you know, the full responsibility of those kids. It's not like you're, you know, a teacher or anything like that, or you're there with them 8 hours a day. You get a little bit of time with them. You get to say hi in the morning, get to say goodbye in the afternoon. You know, you get to hear some of their antics. It's a blast to be on a bus. If I had a nickel for every driver that came back to me and said, hey, this is the best job I ever had, I'd be a millionaire. But it's just a great job. It's a good time to play, you know, have some time with the kids, but at the same time, drive the bus and be the.
Well, Dan and Jennifer, we'll have to leave it there. Dan Kobison and Jennifer DeWitz, they both work in the school bus driver industry, and they joined us today to talk about the shortage of school bus drivers here in Wisconsin. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.